The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. This year, 2024, is an election year in America, a presidential election year. And so we will be doing two podcasts a week rather than our usual one because we want to and because we know you can't get enough Americano in your life. I am delighted to be joined by Sarah Elliott, who runs the US-UK Special Relationship Unit at the Legatum Institute. And we're going to be talking on this Wednesday about Super Tuesday, which was yesterday. And Sarah, I should probably start with the news, the latest news, which is that Nikki Haley appears to have finally dropped out. She's suspended her campaign. It has been reported she will suspend her campaign any moment now. She's expected to do a speech quite soon. It was inevitable, wasn't it, that she was going to drop out after taking, you know, pretty serious beating last night.
Yes, this is no surprise. We knew Super Tuesday was going to be a coronation of Donald Trump. And so much to the chagrin of the Never Trumpers and soft Trump voters hoping for an alternative, we are now in general election mode.
Yes, but there is some theorizing that the Never Trumpers might end up having the last laugh on Donald Trump because some polls suggest 1 in 7 Republican voters will never vote for Donald Trump. If that's true, that is a significant problem for him. And those are exactly the kind of people who are voting for Nikki Haley, who are just, they'd rather stay home or possibly even vote Democrat than vote for Donald Trump. That is a problem for him, is it not?
Oh, it is a problem. And in fact, Nikki Haley, in head-to-head polling with Biden, was much more outpacing Biden in general election polling than Trump. However, you know, it's all about the unknowns, right? And it's all about your opponent. And Biden's numbers with his coalition from 2020 are worse off now than they were then. So, for instance, you have black voters who have grown in up to 23% from 4% in support of Donald Trump now. Trump is leading among young voters. The Latinos, he's leading among Latino voters. There is a 39% swing from Biden to Trump. So it's all about who can keep their coalition together the best and cross the finish line. And they both have terrible approval ratings. Biden has some of the lowest in modern presidential history since polling began at around 40%. I think the latest poll showed 37%.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. We're already talking about the Trump-Biden matchup rather than Super Tuesday, because that's all Super Tuesday was,
yes,
really, is the sort of final goodbye to the primary season, which was really a dud primary season. I mean,
yeah,
for journalists like me, and I'm sure for observers, yeah, like you, it was not the excitement that we like to see in a Democratic contest.
Right. I mean, Republicans have lost three cycles now: 2018, 2020, and 2022. Most people have pointed it down to candidate selection, Donald Trump's name being at the top of the ballot, and his who stole the election narrative, that 2020 was a stolen election. And so for a lot of Republicans who just want to win, they just want to move on from the Trump era. And we're very hopeful that the primary season would put up a fight and give alternatives to Trump so that maybe there's a hope that Republicans can more assuredly win in the future, such as in 2024. Those kind of dreams are now gone. And it's all about, can the Republican base rally around Trump? Will the Democrats rally around Biden? I mean, he has 60% of Democrats would prefer another candidate than,
yes,
Joe Biden.
But Trump's lack of support must be taken, or the amount of sort of nervousness and disunity within Republican circles about Trump must be countered by the fact that he remains extraordinarily popular. I mean, he drives out voters that don't normally vote. He has won the primary cycle like an incumbent, because he is an incumbent. And not just like an incumbent, even stronger than an incumbent in some ways, because he has a movement behind him, and because he has huge mass support that is now, I would say, more powerful than the Republican Party.
Well, he's taken over the Republican Party. Mm. I mean, he put his person in Rona McDaniel, who was just stepped down from RNC chair, but was the longest RNC serving chair. Some would say that it helped rig things in Trump's favor in terms of the primary process and candidate selection. So, yeah, I mean, he's an amazing force that his opposition within the party does not know how to handle.
Yeah.
And that is why we have him as the nominee. I mean, Ron DeSantis, you know, a year ago was thought to be the golden child that could take him out. But he did not know how to fight him in the ring. He was afraid. He didn't confront him directly. He didn't name him. And in fact, he came out, some would say, a bit too late, you know, 6 months after his historic reelection as governor. And then he had that, you know, very embarrassing launch on Twitter or on X to launch his presidential campaign. But so he was supposed to be the alternative and appeal to conservatives and appeal to the Trump base, because let's face it, a lot of the Trump base are in Florida and elected him as governor.
Mm.
And he had many Trump policies as well, and even more conservative than Trump on some things such as COVID. But, you know, he couldn't do it. He didn't know how to attack. And in order to attack Trump or to take him out, you've got to get in the ring with him. You've got to get dirty. But any other politician that has done that, we saw in 2016, it just didn't fare well.
Yes.
So, you know, the question is, why did he even run in the first place if he wasn't even going to attack or be offensive against Trump?
Well, there is no beating him in a Republican contest, it seems. And Nikki Haley has found this out. In her speech today, she's expected to encourage Trump to appeal more to voters who supported her over him. That reads a little bit like a thinly coded appeal for the vice presidential nomination. A lot of talk about this. She has said that she doesn't want it. Trump world would go up in arms because she's very unpopular in large parts of the MAGA movement. Donald Trump Jr. apparently is very against it. Do you think it's possible that Trump might think electorally she does appeal to those suburban women that I seem to struggle with, those affluent sections of the Republican electorate that I just can't seem to win over, and she could sort of get me past that Republican problem I have?
I mean, it would be smart of him to consider her. I think it would be an awkward ticket, considering how the things they've said about each other.
Mm.
You know, would she want to go on a ticket with someone who's called her bird brain?
Yeah.
Would she want to go, you know, she's worked for him before. She's been warning the country, we can't have him again. So what does that say? But, I mean, electorally, it would help. Just like, you know, Mitt Romney needed help with conservatives in 2012. He picked Paul Ryan.
Mm.
And that seemed to solve the problem, although he didn't get him across the line in the general election. But it helped him, you know, rally the base around him. I think probably Trump is looking more towards more loyal women. I do think he's looking at a woman to join him on the ticket. Someone like Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota, you know, a mom of four, you know, very Midwestern values. However, there is a bit of an asterisk there because she's apparently in the press as having an affair with one of Trump's advisors.
Corey Lewandowski. Allegedly, we should say.
Allegedly.
But oddly, that's meant she's out of favor.
Well, you know,
in Trump world,
I'm not sure. They definitely still have contact.
I thought she was proving her loyalty by having an affair with an ultra Trump loyalist.
Maybe not
good enough.
I'm sure Corey got a pat on the back. You never know.
Yeah, some locker room talk.
Yeah, exactly. And you have Carrie Lake of Arizona. You know.
She's very much making it clear that she wants the job.
Yeah.
But the rumor we heard, I think Amber Athey wrote a piece for us about it, is that Trump considers it a bit too desperate.
Yeah.
He doesn't like people to be too desperate.
Well, he doesn't like attention-seeking people who would steal the limelight away from him.
Yes.
So there's this, we got to create this Venn diagram. Who's like attractive physically enough?
Yeah.
Who's also like loyal enough?
Yes.
MAGA enough, but won't take away from the Donald? So.
Well, that's, yeah, I mean, I think think you put your finger on something important there, which is he probably wants somebody slightly boring.
Like Mike Pence.
Like Mike Pence, because Mike Pence was, in a way, a brilliant choice for 2016, because he was he reassured a lot of Republicans that this wasn't some great departure from the party they knew. And he was dull and plodding, and Trump doesn't...
And conservative.
And conservative, yeah. And Trump likes to be the centre of attention, obviously. He does not want anybody who's going to create tremendous waves. So yeah. We should be looking at somebody quite boring and possibly a woman, you're saying, for...
Yeah, but attractive.
Boring but attractive.
Yeah, yeah. He likes attractive... He likes to hire attractive people. I mean...
But not so attractive that they become exciting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well,
Tulsi Gabbard, she's talked about.
Wow, that's an interesting one. I mean, also about this time picking a VP. Last time he had to pick a conservative VP, right? Because he had trouble with conservatives. Mm. Now he doesn't have trouble with conservatives at all.
Yeah,
he actually outpaced Nikki Haley with conservatives in every race, and beat out Ron DeSantis in Iowa. Now he needs to find someone who appeals to moderates. So he needs a more moderate VP, which Tulsi Gabbard might be a nice alternative.
Yeah, I should say for people that don't know, she ran to be the Democratic president in 2020, and she is a kind of anti-war. She's quite an interesting voice. She appears on Fox News quite a lot.
Yeah, she's a Democrat, former congresswoman.
Veteran. Military vet. Yeah.
She's a military vet. She's pro-Second Amendment.
Yeah.
Also, she's native... I think she is a native Hawaiian background. And, very anti-war. She even met with Assad. Do you remember that? She went out to Syria and met Assad several years ago.
Yeah, she got in a lot of trouble for that.
Yeah, she did.
Yeah.
She's an interesting one. She's been at CPAC. She's been a speaker at CPAC before.
Yeah.
I think there's potential. She's very telegenic. I think that would be an interesting choice.
Just but a bit too interesting.
Yeah,
we've got to find this boring one, which we're not finding it.
But or a Democrat.
A Democrat would be interesting. Who would that be?
Yeah, I don't know.
If not Tulsi.
Because, Tulsi is a great one. RFK Jr.?
Yeah, that's...
But I think that's a bit too radical.
We shall see. The other big news this week was Monday, the Supreme Court ruling that the state of Colorado could not bar Donald Trump from the ballot. On grounds of insurrection under the 14th Amendment. This is an important bit of lawfare that has been sort of rebuffed now against Donald Trump.
Yeah.
There is a lot more in the pipeline coming up, a lot more court cases and so on. But the mood this week certainly seems to be, we can finally now stop this legal persecution of Donald Trump and just get down to a democratic battle that I think most people think we now have to have between Donald Trump and Joe Biden.
Yes, absolutely. The general election starts now.
Yeah.
The question is, can both one's an octogenarian and one's almost one, can they make it to election day? So,
yes.
I mean, my question is, I think Trump is in, you know, great health for his age and he seems to have his faculties. It's the question about Biden. And will he really be the nominee for the Democrats? Will the Democrats really want to place their fortunes on him? You know, after the DOJ came back and said that report that they couldn't prosecute the president for mishandling documents because he doesn't have the mental faculties to be held up in court, 85% of the country doesn't think he should be president.
But how do you stop Joe Biden being president? There's sort of three scenarios that you can imagine. One is death, which is possible when you're talking about a very old man. The second is sort of incapacity so dire that it's obvious that he can't run. The third is that he's persuaded to stand down, because unless he's persuaded to stand down, it's very hard to see how the Democrats can actually block him at the convention. It would require something so extraordinary now that it's hard to imagine what that might be.
So my sources say that Jill Biden is the one that's really pushing him to stay in the race.
Yes.
Joe Biden has always been, not that supported in the party, or has been the underdog. The Obamas disregarded him, didn't rate him. The Clintons, pushed him aside, said it's not your turn. And now that he's president, you know, Jill's like, no, we're holding on to this. We got this. It's our turn.
Yeah.
You've never given us the credit we deserve, and so we're going for it.
Yeah.
But I could see a scenario happening this summer, right before the convention. Uh-oh, health, incapacitated, can't do it. So at the convention, they have to make a behind doors decision as to who do we put forward.
Yes.
An equally unpopular Kamala Harris, or do we put the left-wing American psycho like Gavin Newsom?
Yes.
Or do we do an unknown or some minority ethnic from the cabinet?
Well, this speaks to the deep dysfunction that there seems to be in American democracy at the moment, because you have this race between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, it seems, which a majority of Americans say they would rather have different candidates. And then if one of them drops out, it'll be back to, you know, smoke-filled, probably not smoke-filled rooms.
Vaped-filled. Marijuana-filled rooms.
Yeah. But where, you know, decisions are taken behind closed doors as to what actually happens after this whole democratic process is done.
Yeah. And apparently, a top issue for Democrats is saving the democracy. And yet it's probably their party that could very potentially subvert it with some kind of handpicking. And if you remember in 2016, it was very close between Hillary and Bernie Sanders.
Yes.
But yet all the superdelegates went to Hillary. And she became the nominee.
They stitched Bernie up.
There's an argument for that.
I think it's fair. It's more than an argument. It's obviously true.
It's kind of obvious. Yeah.
But speaking of stitching things up, Natasha, my producer, who's our producer, who's just run out, is keen for us to use this phrase, too big to rig. Have you heard Donald Trump using this phrase?
Too big to rig.
I had not actually heard it.
No.
I must admit, even though I try and follow these things closely. Trump has been saying on the campaign trail, we want our win to be too big to rig.
Well,
so it's so overwhelming that they can't, that the Democrats can't cheat and steal the election like they did last time. Obviously, we don't want to get into the conspiracy theories about 2020 because that's a place from which you never escape. I think Trump is talking about victory as a kind of landslide. And I've spoken to a couple of Republican pollsters who are now starting to say, you know, we're looking at landslide territory here, because if you look at the swing states, you know, certainly on polling at the moment, he's ahead in Georgia, he's ahead in Arizona, he's ahead in Nevada, he's ahead in Michigan, he's ahead in Pennsylvania, according to two polls recently. Wisconsin, the latest polls have Biden slightly ahead, so we can discount Wisconsin. But if Trump wins, you know, just three of those ones, then the race is done.
It's in the margin of error, right?
Yeah.
And we also have to remember that Obama won those states within the margin of error.
Yeah.
You know, it's always been close and divided. I think Wisconsin is the state to watch.
Yes.
Because it was the fact in 2016, he won those suburban districts outside of Milwaukee that pushed him over the edge. And the same with places in Michigan. And I think this lawfare, this weaponization of the law going after Donald Trump is totally going to backfire on the Democrats. I mean, in one way, I think the Democrats have wanted Trump to be the nominee because he's much more beatable than, say, a Nikki Haley or a Ron DeSantis. But I think people are going to go, listen, we see your agenda. We also see you abusing our system, where you find the criminal but not the crime, and you're going after him and just nitpicking him. And we're not going to have it anymore. And they may come out in droves to make a point.
Do you remember the 2020 debates between Joe Biden and Donald Trump?
Mm-hmm.
They were pretty dire, weren't they? They were poor quality debates.
Yeah.
Between, you know, the first one was extremely angry. They both came out sort of trying to be fighty. But Biden is not very compos mentis. That's the politest way I can think of putting it. Trump is actually not a very good debater. He's never been a very good debater. He's quite good at imposing himself. He did it a little bit against Hillary Clinton, but he's not that smart or whatever across the facts. You know, he's not one for detail. Do you think we'll have debates, given that maybe both candidates will think there's no upside in it for me?
I think Donald Trump wants to debate Joe.
Yeah.
Only because he's so diminished.
Yes.
And I you know, when you're in the ring and you see your opponent withering in the corner, you want to do a couple knockout punches to win. And I think Trump is a red meat kind of guy and would want to do that. I don't think he has any kind of empathy or sympathy for people. And to be honest with you, that's what his base wants.
Yeah.
That's why they've hung in here with Trump. They want to see their fighter finally win.
Yes.
In like the fourth Rocky movie, you know?
Yes. Well, it's interesting you talk about it like that, because the cover of this week's Spectator is Revenge, is the cover line. And the piece is, which I've written, is about Trump's obsession with revenge, which is quite interesting. And my thesis, if you can call it that, probably to give it a bit too much importance, my idea is that actually quite a lot of Americans love the idea of Trump's revenge. They feel that the lawfare against him was very unfair, and they don't have to be big MAGA people or Trump lovers to think this. They think that the Democrats deserve to be punished for what they're doing. And retribution, which is this leitmotif of Trump's campaign, has a certain amount of appeal to a democratic American audience.
Yeah. Oh, completely. And this is
democratic
why,
small d there. Yeah.
Small d. This is why I think he's winning over minorities. You know, the black community, even by Democrats have preached this for decades, feel like they are racially targeted, unfairly targeted by the law, by law enforcement. And then they see this guy and they go, hey, yeah, he's being chased by the Fulton DA. Yeah. So have I, you know, like I can relate to this guy.
Yes.
He's being unfairly targeted by these people. They see the big picture. And also look at the way the Democrats have managed their cities and minority communities since the Black Lives Matter movement and the riots and the defund the police. I mean, people are just sick. Our cities are in the gutter right now.
Yes.
You know?
And there are three figures there who incense a lot of voters. I think Fannie Willis is the one in Georgia who's going after Trump and has had this affair with one of her prosecutors.
Oh, it's great reality TV.
You couldn't make up.
You
couldn't make up a more disastrous prosecutor of any crime, really. And then you have Alvin Bragg in New York.
Yeah.
You have Letitia James in New York. And these are all figures who are in trouble on other fronts for not getting on top of law and order, which is supposed to be their job.
Yes.
Because they're obsessing
with
going after Donald Trump for obviously political, obviously partisan reasons. And voters notice that. I mean, it's not just, you know, a right-wing talking point. It's, you know, from the moment Donald Trump's photograph was taken in Fulton County Jailhouse, his popularity has just gone up and up and up.
Well, ever since Mar-a-Lago got raided.
Yeah.
You know? And what was this? That Joe Biden had boxes of documents next to his Chevrolet, next to his Corvette in a garage.
Yeah.
And like that didn't happen? I mean, listen, there are nuances here in the way one responds to law enforcement and doesn't. But still.
But Biden can't be blamed for that because he's mentally not there.
But he can be the, you know, the one who controls the nuclear weapon buttons in the White House and commander-in-chief of our military. I mean,
yes.
Yeah. So it makes sense. I mean, this is what's wrong with the system, where people say, like, common sense is not being respected and hasn't actually for decades.
Mm.
But, you know, like it's one thing for the ruling class and one thing for us. And one thing that, you know, I don't think was discussed enough was in 2016, the reason Trump was so popular and there's this populist movement that I think emanates from the Tea Party movement of 2010 is that wage growth had not gone above inflation for the working and middle classes. You know, the managerial class was doing fine, the laptop class.
Mm.
But for a vast majority of workers in this country, that was not the case. They were losing money. They couldn't get ahead. They couldn't buy a house. They're having trouble putting food on the table, putting gas in their car, petrol. You know, and he spoke to that. And he spoke common sense. He wasn't politically correct. He didn't do wokeism. And this is the attraction of Donald Trump.
Yes.
And he has a third of the Republican Party on lockdown. He's got a third of them who are conservatives, who are soft Trump voters that he can convince. And then he has a third that are never Trumpers. And he does have a problem with that set, we've already talked about that.
Mm.
But that middle third is just like, you know, it doesn't matter who the other nominees are in the primary. This guy is being attacked by the justice system, has since the day he got elected,
yeah.
The whole Russian collusion stuff. Listen, I'm sick of it. We're going to stick with this guy. And I think he then appeals to independents and some Democrats because of that.
You talked about wage growth lagging behind inflation, which points towards probably the thing that will decide it, because it's usually the thing that decides whether first-term presidents win an election, is the economy. And the big indicators, we're certainly told that you know, the American economy is picking up, that the Biden administration seems convinced that, you know, voters are going to start feeling good about the economy again. They're not at the moment, even though the figures are good. You know, that's going to be the factor, that if Biden can convey some sense of feel good about the American economy, then he probably could still win.
I mean, possibly. The problem is there's all this compounded inflation from all his big government omnibus spending bills, like the Inflation Reduction Act, et cetera. And you've got to, you know, start cutting government spending and regulation, get things moving. And he's also hampered our energy sector so much, and liquid natural gas, and putting moratoriums on that. And it's all about the green agenda. When people are like, can I just, you know, put my kids through school? Can I just feed, you know, my family, or you know, be able to go on holiday this year? I don't think the economy is going to pick up enough and feel good enough under this administration that by November they're going to be like, you know what, I am better off now than I was 4 years ago. I don't think that'll be the case.
And of course, the other big issue, voter concern now, according to most polls, the primary voter concern is immigration, which Trump's rhetoric is tough. It's brutal often. He talks about, you know, a death penalty for child traffickers and so on. He talks about deporting undocumented migrants and so on. But that's very popular.
Yeah. Well, you know, he goes down to the border and he talks about the dangers of illegal immigration, like the young woman in Georgia who just recently was murdered by an illegal immigrant when she was out running at the University of Georgia. Laken Riley, I think is her name. And then you have Joe Biden, who's at the border, talking about green energy. And it's completely out of touch with reality, you know? And voters see this and go, we've had over 6 million illegal crossings in 3 years. 3 years. Over 200 people are on the FBI most wanted list, have been captured. How many people haven't been captured in these gotaways? You know, I mean, people are gearing up for like another 9/11 terrorist attack happening. They've videoed all different types of people from all over the world, not from friendly nation states, mind you, crossing that border. So it is a huge issue. Trump is polling 52% to 30%, so way ahead of Biden in a lot of these swing states on immigration. And Biden just is like, has ostrich syndrome, just putting his head in the sand or talking about Green New Deal. I mean, it's very much like what's happening here. Like these elites, you know, kind of want to bring everyone into their utopia of this vision of how things should be. But the reality is it's not good and they're not facing it.
Yes. You're quite right to point out that actually, because I think a lot of times British people or Europeans think that America's immigration problem, illegal immigration, is purely Hispanic people coming from Latin America, Central America. But actually, it's part of the global refugee problem, illegal migration problem. And they're coming like they are in Britain and Europe. They're coming from Central Africa. They're coming
China,
from Syria,
Haiti, Afghanistan, I mean, all over.
Yeah.
But that's new. That's a new element since the Biden years. And also the drug epidemic in the U.S., which is not talked about, the fentanyl crisis in America, which is just pouring across the border with these drug cartels. You know, they're killing over 100,000 Americans a year in drug overdoses. Simple drugs are being laced with this, which fentanyl is much cheaper to make. It's addictive and it can also kill you much quicker. And it's just taking young lives all across the country.
Well, and Donald Trump talks about that very directly, too. And I suppose the criticism of Trump, the more intelligent criticism of Trump, is that you've heard it all before and he didn't really do anything about it. And I suppose lots of Trump people say actually he did do lots of things and so on, but I think that's a matter for debate. But in terms of an election, when it's really about your message, Trump says things voters want to hear. Joe Biden doesn't seem to do that as much.
But I think what cannot be underestimated is the anti-Trump sentiment in the country.
Yes.
And this is what makes him so risky to be the nominee and to put him at the top of the ballot again. Because as I said before, we've lost three cycles with him at the top or associated with the Republican Party. He is the best boogeyman for the Democrats and the left. Mm. So if Biden is not the nominee at the end of the day, I think we're in real trouble, the Republicans. Because I think he would, you know, he'll be less appealing, even more less appealing.
And lastly, Sarah, I should ask you about the special relationship, because you had a great party last night at the Legatum Institute to launch your new unit.
Yes.
About the special relationship. I mean, the obvious conclusion someone like me makes is that Biden is not in favor of the special relationship. He doesn't seem very keen on it. Donald Trump loves Britain, loves talking about Britain, loves the monarchy and so on, talks about his Scottish mother. So if you're an Englishman looking for good relationships with America, Donald Trump seems like a better bet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it is. And he, you know, for instance, Joe Biden has outright rejected a free trade deal or any trade deal with the UK right now.
Yeah.
I think there were things in the work under the last Trump administration, and that can continue. We can pick up where we left off. He was a big fan of the UK. His mother was Scottish. You know, what I would say to Brits who do not like Trump or have issues with him, you know, it's better to look at what you have in common than look at what the differences are.
Yeah.
And try and make it work, because, you know, our threats are now worse than they were 4 years ago geopolitically, and we need to work together even more so.
Well, and actually the Labour Party, who will probably be in power by the time of the next administration, if it is a Trump administration, are talking sensibly about Donald Trump. David Lammy, who was this great anti-Trump voice in the first term, who is likely to be foreign secretary, he has started to suggest, I think, that he'd be more open to working with him. So,
Good. I'm glad to see that David Lammy has some sense of decorum and restraint and diplomacy, which he could have been using in the last Trump administration, but chose not to. But I hope he does use it if he is foreign secretary. The reason we have the special relationship unit now is because we need to further on that great clarion call of Winston Churchill to stay closely united after the Second World War. That was 78 years ago yesterday that he said it for the first time. And you know, we do have so much in common, regardless of who's president or prime minister. I mean, our legal system, our constitution, took so much from the British common law and Magna Carta and constitution. Over 36 million Americans claim to have British ancestry. And I think it's a wonderful alliance that has underpinned transatlantic democracy for, you know, in the post-war order. And it needs to, in order to keep people free in the 21st century.
We are one people divided by a common language. Did Mencken say that?
No, I do. I think it was Churchill that said that. And being that I live in a special relationship every day, I can attest to that very much.
Thank you very much, Sarah.
My pleasure. And honestly, Freddie, I'm such a fangirl of your show, so keep it up.
Oh, wow. Well, come back again. That's all for this episode of the Americano podcast. I'd like to thank my brilliant producer, Natasha Ferrose, and urge you to leave a generous, kind, and warm-hearted review of this podcast on whichever platform you listen to it.